her eyes. But just for an instant, as she looked at him, he saw a gleam in her eyes, and, though the spark was at once extinguished, that one instant made him happy. She glanced at her husband to see whether he knew Vronsky. Karenin looked at him with displeasure, absently trying to recall who he might be. Vronsky's calm self-confidence struck like a scythe on a stone against the cold self-confidence of Karenin. "Count Vronsky," said Anna.
"Ah, I believe we have met before," said Karenin, extending his hand with indifference. "You travelled there with the mother and came back with the son," he said, uttering every word distinctly as though it were something valuable he was giving away. "I suppose you are returning from furlough," he remarked, and without waiting for an answer, said to his wife in his playful manner, "Well, were many tears shed in Moscow over the parting?"
By addressing himself thus to his wife, he conveyed to Vronsky his wish to be alone with her, and turning to Vronsky, he touched his hat. But Vronsky, addressing Anna, said, "I hope to have the honour of calling on you." Karenin glanced at him with his weary eyes.
"I shall be very pleased," he said coldly. "We are at home on Mondays."
Then, having finally dismissed Vronsky, he said to his wife in his usual bantering tone, "What a good thing it was that I had just half an hour to spare to meet you and was able to show my devotion."
"You insist too much on your devotion for me to value it greatly," she replied in the same playful tone, while she involuntarily listened to the sound of Vronsky's footsteps following them. "But what does he matter to me?" she asked herself, and began inquiring of her husband how Seretse had got on during her absence.
"Oh, splendidly. Mariette says he was very sweet. But, I'm sorry to grieve you, he did not fret after you,
like your husband.
But I must thank you once again, my dear, for having made me the present of a day. Our dear Samovar will be in ecstasies."
He called the celebrated Countess Lydia Ivanovna Samovar because she was always getting heated and boiling over about something.
"She was asking after you, and do you know, if I may advise, you should go and see her today. Her heart is always aching about somebody. At present, in addition to all her other worries, she is concerned about the Oblonskys' reconciliation."
Countess Lydia Ivanovna was Anna's husband's friend, and the centre of that set in Petersburg society with which Anna, through her husband, was most closely connected.
"But I wrote to her."
"Yes, but she wants the particulars."
"Go and see her, my dear, if you're not too tired. Kondrati is here with the carriage for you, and I must be off to the committee. Now I shan't have to dine alone," he went on, no longer in a bantering manner.
"You can't think how I used—"
And with a long pressure of her hand and a special kind of smile, he helped her into the carriage. Chapter 32. The first person to meet Anna when she reached home was her son. He ran down the stairs to her, regardless of his governess's cries, and with desperate delight called out, "Mama! Mama!" When he reached her, he clung round her neck.
"I told you it was Mama!" he shouted to the governess. "I knew!"
Her son, like his father, produced on Anna a feeling akin to disappointment. Her fancy had pictured him nicer than he was in reality. She had to come down to reality in order to enjoy him as he was. But even as he was charming with his fair curls, blue eyes, and plump, shapely legs in tight-fitting stockings. Anna experienced an almost physical pleasure in feeling his proximity and his caresses, and a moral solace when she met his simple, trustful, and loving gaze and heard his naive questions. She unpacked the presents which Dolly's children had sent him, and told him that there was a girl in Moscow whose name was Tanya who could read and even teach other children.
"And am I worse than she?" asked Seretse.
"To me you are the best in the world."
"I know," he said, smiling.
Before Anna had time to finish her coffee, the Countess Lydia Ivanovna was announced.
The Countess was a tall, stout woman with a sickly, sallow complexion and beautiful, dreamy black eyes. Anna was fond of her, but today she seemed to see her for the first time with all her defects.
"Well, my dear, did you take the olive branch?" asked the Countess Lydia Ivanovna as soon as she entered the room.
"Yes, it's all over."
"But the whole affair was not as serious as we thought," Anna replied.
"My sister-in-law is, in general, too impulsive." But the Countess, who was interested in everything that did not concern her, had a habit of never listening to what interested her, and she interrupted Anna.
"Ah, yes, there is much sorrow and evil in the world, and today I'm terribly worried."
"Why? What is the matter?" asked Anna, trying to suppress a smile.
"I am getting tired of breaking lances uselessly in the cause of truth, and sometimes I feel quite unstrung. That little sister's affair," this was a philanthropic religio-patriotic society, "was going splendidly. But to work with those gentlemen is impossible," continued the Countess Lydia Ivanovna, with an ironical air of resignation to fate. "They took the idea and perverted it, and are now discussing it in such a trivial, petty way. Two or three, your husband among them, understand the full significance of the affair, but the others just drop it. Yesterday I had a letter from Pravdin." Pravdin was a well-known Panslavist who resided abroad. The Countess told Anna what he had written. She then went on to tell her of other unpleasantnesses, and of the underhand opposition to the plan for uniting the churches, and she went away in a hurry, as she had that afternoon to be at a meeting of another society, as well as to attend a Slavonic committee meeting. "This is all just as it was before. But how is it that I never noticed it before?" said Anna to herself. "Or is it that she is specially irritated this morning? But it is really funny. Her aim is to do good. She is a Christian, and yet she's always angry and always has enemies, all on account of Christianity and philanthropy."
After the Countess had left, a friend, a high official's wife, arrived and gave Anna all the Petersburg news. At 3, she also left, promising to come back to dinner. Karenin was at the ministry. Anna, left alone, spent part of the time before dinner in seeing her son have his dinner, he dined apart, in putting her things in order, and in reading and answering the notes and letters that had accumulated on her table. The feeling of causeless shame she had felt during the journey and her agitation had quite vanished. In her accustomed conditions of life, she again felt firm and blameless. She thought with wonder of her state the day before. What had happened? Nothing. Vronsky said some silly things to which it will be easy to put a stop, and I said what was necessary. It is unnecessary and impossible to speak of it to my husband. To speak of it would be to give it an importance that does not belong to it. She remembered how she had once told her husband about one of his subordinates who very nearly made her a declaration, and how Karenin had answered that every woman living in society was liable to such things, but that he had full confidence in her tact and would never degrade himself and her by being jealous. So there is no need to tell him. Besides, thank heaven, there is nothing to tell, she said to herself.
Chapter 33 Karenin returned from the ministry at 4 o'clock, but, as often happened, he had no time to go up and see his wife. He went straight to his study to receive some petitioners and sign a few documents brought by his private secretary. At the Karenins' dinners there were usually about 3 visitors. This time there came an old lady, a cousin of Karenin's, the director of a department, the director's wife, and a young man who had been recommended to Karenin for a post under him. Anna went into the drawing-room to entertain them. Exactly at 5, the bronze clock style of Peter I had not finished striking, Karenin entered in evening dress with a white tie and 2 stars on his coat, as he had to attend an official meeting directly after dinner. Every moment of his life was filled up and apportioned, and in order to find time to perform all the tasks allotted to each day, he observed the strictest regularity. "Without haste and without rest," was his motto. He entered the room, greeted everybody, and quickly sat down, smiling at his wife. "So my solitude has come to an end. You wouldn't believe how uncomfortable," he put special emphasis on the word uncomfortable, "it is to dine alone." At dinner he spoke a little about Moscow affairs with his wife, asking with an ironical smile after Stepan Oblonsky. But for the most part the conversation was general and dealt with Petersburg service and social affairs. After dinner he spent half an hour with his guests, and then, having again with a smile pressed his wife's hand, went away to the council. That evening Anna went neither to see the Princess Betsy Tverskaya, who, having heard of Anna's return, had invited her, nor to the theatre, where she had a box for that evening. Her chief reason for not going was that a dress on which she had counted was not ready. Altogether, when, after her visitors had left, Anna busied herself with her toilet, she was much vexed. Before going to Moscow, she, being an adept at dressing on comparatively little money, left 3 dresses to be altered. She wanted them made up so that they should be unrecognizable, and they were to have been sent home 3 days ago. But she now found that 2 were not ready at all, while the 3rd had not been done in the way she wished. The dressmaker came to explain that it was better as she had done it, and Anna lost her temper to such a degree that she afterwards felt ashamed. Completely to regain her composure, she went to the nursery and spent the evening with her son. She put him to bed herself, made the sign of the cross over him, and tucked him up. She was glad she had not gone out that evening, but had spent it so pleasantly at home. She felt light-hearted and tranquil, and saw clearly that what in the train had appeared so important had merely been an ordinary and trivial incident of society life, and that there was no reason for her to feel ashamed or for anyone to blame her. She sat down by the fire with an English novel and awaited her husband. Exactly at 9:30 there was a ring at the front door, and he entered the room. "Here you are at last," she said, holding out her hand to him. He kissed it and seated himself beside her. "In general, I see that your journey has been a success," said he. "Yes, quite," she replied, and related everything that had happened from the beginning, her journey with the Countess Vronskaya, her arrival, the accident at the railway station. Then she spoke of her pity, first for her brother, and then for Dolly. "I don't think that one can excuse such a man, even though he is your brother," remarked Karenin severely. Anna smiled. She knew he had said that in order to show that no consideration of kinship could hinder the expression of his sincere opinion. She knew that trait in her husband's character, knew and liked it. "I am glad it has all ended satisfactorily, and that you are back again," he continued. "But what are they saying there about the new statute I carried in the council?" Anna had heard nothing about the statute, and felt ashamed that she had so lightly forgotten what was of such importance to him. "Here, on the contrary, it has made quite a stir," he said with a self-satisfied smile. Anna saw that he wanted to tell her something pleasant to himself about that affair, and by questioning she led him on to tell her all about it. With the same self-satisfied smile he told her about the ovations he had received on account of the enactment of that statute. "I was very, very pleased. It shows that at last a clear and reasonable view of the matter is beginning to be firmly held among us." Having finished his second cup of tea and cream and his bread and butter, he rose and went into his study.
"And have you not been out anywhere? You must have been dull," he said.
"Oh, no," she answered, rising and following him through the room to his study.
"And what are you reading now?"
she asked.
"I am now reading the Duc de Lille's Poésie des Enfers," he replied. "A very remarkable book."
Anna smiled as one smiles at the weaknesses of people one loves, and slipping her hand under his arm, walked with him to the study door. She knew his habit, which had become a necessity, of reading in the evening.
She knew that, in spite of his time being almost entirely absorbed by the duties of his post, he considered it incumbent on him to follow everything of importance that appeared in the world of thought. She also knew that really he was interested in political, philosophic, and theological books, and that art was quite foreign to his nature. Yet in spite of this, or rather because of it, he never ignored anything that caused a stir in that sphere, but considered it his duty to read everything. She knew that in the sphere of politics, philosophy, and theology, Alexei Alexandrovich doubted and searched. But in questions of art, poetry, and especially music, which he did not at all understand, he held most definite and firm opinions. He liked talking of Shakespeare, Raphael, and Beethoven, and about the importance of the new schools of poetry and music, which in his mind were all classified with very logical exactitude. "Well, God bless you," she said at the door of the study, where a shaded candle and a bottle of water had been placed ready for him beside his armchair. "And I will go and write to them in Moscow." He pressed her hand and again kissed it. "After all, he is a good man. Truthful, kind, and remarkable in his own sphere," said Anna to herself, when she'd returned to her room, as if defending him from someone who accused him and declared it was impossible to love him. "But why do his ears stick out so? Or has he had his hair cut?" Exactly at midnight, when Anna was still sitting at her writing table finishing a letter to Dolly, she heard the measured tread of slippered feet, and Karenin entered, freshly washed, his hair brushed, and a book under his arm. "It's time. It's time," said he, with a peculiar smile, going into their bedroom. And what right had he to look at him as he did, thought Anna, remembering how Vronsky had looked at Karenin. When she was undressed, she went into the bedroom. But on her face not only was there not a trace of that animation which during her stay in Moscow had sparkled in her eyes and smile, but on the contrary the fire in her now seemed quenched, or hidden somewhere very far away. Chapter 34 When he went to Moscow, Vronsky had left his large flat on the Morskaya to his friend and favourite comrade, Petritsky. Petritsky was a young lieutenant, not of very aristocratic birth, and not only not wealthy, but heavily in debt, tipsy every evening, and often under arrest for amusing or improper escapades, but popular both with his comrades and superiors. Arriving home from the station about noon, Vronsky recognised a hired brougham at the front door. When he rang the bell, while still outside, he heard men's laughter, a woman's lisping voice, and Petritsky shouting, "If it is one of the villains, don't let him in!" Vronsky told the servants not to announce his arrival, and softly entered the first room. Petritsky's friend, the Baroness Chilton, her lilac satin dress and pink and white face glistening, and like a canary filling the whole room with her Parisian voice, was seated at the round table making coffee. Petritsky, in his greatcoat, and Captain Kamarovsky, in full uniform, probably straight from parade, sat on each side of her.
"Vronsky! Bravo!"
exclaimed Petritsky, jumping up and noisily pushing back his chair.
"The master himself! Baroness, some coffee for him out of the new coffee pot. Well, this is unexpected. I hope you're pleased with this ornament to your study," he added, pointing to the Baroness. "Of course you know one another."
"I should think so," replied Vronsky with a merry smile as he pressed the Baroness's small hand. "Of course. Quite old friends."
"You have returned from a journey?" said the Baroness.
"Oh, I'll be off home this very moment if I am in the way."
"You are at home where you are, Baroness," said Vronsky. "How do you do, Kamarovsky?" he added, coldly shaking hands with the captain.
"There now, you never managed to say such pretty things," said the Baroness to Petritsky.
"Oh, yes, why not? After dinner I'll say things quite as good as that."
"But after dinner there is no merit in it."
"Well, then I'll give you some coffee. But have a wash and smarten yourself up.
said the Baroness, again sitting down and carefully turning a small screw of the coffee-pot.
"Pierre, pass me the coffee," she said to Petritsky, whom, not concealing their relations, she called Pierre, the French for Peter, because of his surname. "I'll put a little more into the pot."
"You'll spoil it."
"No, I shan't."
"And your wife?"
the Baroness said, suddenly interrupting Vronsky's conversation with his comrade.
"We here have been marrying you off. Have you brought your wife?"
"No, Baroness. A Bohemian I was born, and a Bohemian I shall die."
"So much the better. So much the better. Give me your hand."
And the Baroness, instead of releasing Vronsky, began telling him her plans for the future, interspersing jokes and asking his advice.
"He won't agree to a divorce. Whatever am I to do?"
He was her husband.
"I want to begin an action. What would you advise?" Kamarovsky, mind the coffee, it's boiling over. Don't you see I'm occupied? I want to bring an action because I need my property. You see how absurd it is that because I am supposed to be unfaithful," she said contemptuously, "he wishes to have the use of my property."
Vronsky listened with pleasure to the merry prattle of the pretty young woman, agreed with what she said, and half in fun gave her advice. In a word, he immediately took up his habitual manner with women of her kind. In his Petersburg world, people were divided into two quite opposite sorts. One, the inferior sort, the paltry, stupid, and above all ridiculous people who believe that a husband should live with the one wife to whom he is married, that a maiden should be pure, a woman modest, and a man manly, self-controlled, and firm, that one should bring up one's children to earn their living, should pay one's debts, and other nonsense of that kind. These were the old-fashioned and ridiculous people. But there was another sort of people, the real people to which all his set belonged, who had, above all, to be well-bred, generous, bold, gay, and to abandon themselves unblushingly to all their passions and laugh at everything else. Just for a moment, Vronsky was staggered, having brought back from Moscow the impression of a totally different world. But immediately, as though he had put his foot into an old slipper, he re-entered his former gay and pleasant world. The coffee never got made, but boiled over and splashed everybody, effecting just what was required. That is, it gave an excuse for much noise and laughter, staining the valuable carpet and the Baroness's dress.
"Now, goodbye, or you'll never get washed, and on my conscience will lie the greatest crime of a gentleman, want of cleanliness.
So you advise me to put a knife to his throat?"
"Most certainly, and hold it so that your hand will be near his lips. He will kiss the hand, and all will end well," said Vronsky.
"Then we meet at the French theatre tonight?"
And, her dress rustling, she vanished. Kamarovsky rose also, and without waiting for him to go, Vronsky shook hands with him and went to his dressing room. While he was washing, Petritsky, in a few words, described his own position insofar as it had changed since Vronsky went away. He had no money at all. His father had said he would not give him any and would not pay his debts. His tailor and another creditor were threatening him with arrest. His CO had announced to him that if these scandals continued, he, Petritsky, would have to resign. He was sick to death of the Baroness, especially because she was always wanting to give him money. But there was another, he would let Vronsky see her, who was charming, wonderful, of severely oriental type, in the style of the slave Rebecca, you know. He had also had a quarrel with Berkashev, who wished to send his seconds, but of course nothing would come of it. But in general, everything was first-rate and extremely jolly. And without letting his friend go into details of his position, Petritsky began telling him all the interesting news. Listening to Petritsky's familiar tales in the familiar surroundings of the house he had lived in for 3 years, Vronsky experienced the satisfaction of returning to his customary, careless Petersburg life.
"Impossible!" he cried, releasing the pedal of his washstand, which controlled a jet of water under which he was bathing his healthy, ruddy neck. "Impossible!" he cried at the news that Laura was under the protection of Milyeyev and had thrown up Fertinov. "And he is still as stupid and self-satisfied? And what of Batsulukov? Oh, about Batsulukov, there is such a tale. Splendid, shouted Petritsky. You know his passion for balls? He never misses a single court ball. He went to a grand ball wearing one of the new helmets. Have you seen the new helmets? Oh, they're very good, much lighter. Well, he stood... But you're not listening. Yes, I am, replied Vronsky, rubbing himself with a bath towel. The Grand Duchess passed by with one of the ambassadors, and, as his ill luck would have it, they were discussing the new helmets. The Grand Duchess wishes to show him one of them. She sees our dear Batsulukov standing there. Petritsky imitated the pose. The Grand Duchess asks him for his helmet, but he won't let her have it. Oh, what can this mean? They wink at him, nod, frown to make him give it up. No, he stands there more dead than alive. Just imagine it. That, what's his name, wishes to take it from him, but he won't let go. The other snatches it away and hands it to the Grand Duchess. Here, this is one of the new ones, says the Grand Duchess, turning it over, and just fancy, out tumbles a pear and sweets. £2 of them. The dear fellow had collected them in his helmet.
Vronsky shook with laughter, and long after, when he was already talking of other things, he again went off into roars of hearty laughter, showing his compact row of strong teeth at the remembrance of the helmet. Having heard all the news, Vronsky, with the help of his valet, put on his uniform and went to report himself. After that, he intended to go to see his brother and to see Betsy, and to pay a few calls in order to begin visiting the set in which he could meet Anna Karenina. As usual in Petersburg, he left the house, not to return till late at night. Part 2 Chapter 1 Toward the end of the winter, a consultation was held at the Shabatskys, which was intended to ascertain the state of Kitty's health and to decide what should be done to restore her failing strength. She was ill, and with the approach of spring, grew worse. Their own doctor prescribed cod liver oil, then iron, and then nitrate of silver. But as none of them did her any good, and as he advised her to go abroad for the spring, they sent for a celebrated specialist. The celebrated specialist, a very handsome man, and by no means old, insisted on sounding the invalid. He, with particular pleasure, as it seemed, insisted that a maidenly sense of shame is only a relic of barbarism, and that nothing is more natural than for a man still in his prime to handle a young woman's naked body. He considered this natural because he did it every day, and did not, it seemed to him, either feel or think anything wrong when he did it. He therefore considered the feeling of shame in a girl to be not only a relic of barbarism, but an insult to him. They had to submit. For although all the doctors studied in the same schools and from the same books and knew the same sciences, and though some said that this celebrated man was a bad doctor, at the Princess Shcherbatskaya's and in her set it was for some reason assumed that he alone had a quite special knowledge and he alone could save Kitty. After having carefully examined and sounded the agitated invalid, who was stupefied with shame, the celebrity, having carefully washed his hands, stood in the drawing-room talking to the prince. The prince frowned and coughed as he listened to the doctor. As a man who had lived in the world and was neither stupid nor ill, the prince did not believe in medicine, and in his heart was vexed at this farce, especially as he himself was probably the only one who thoroughly understood the cause of Kitty's illness. What a windbag, he thought, as he listened to the celebrated doctor's chatter about Kitty's symptoms. The doctor, meanwhile, found it hard not to show his contempt for the old fellow, and with difficulty descended to the level of his comprehension. He saw that it was waste of time to talk to him, and that the head in this house was the mother. It was before her that he meant to spread his pearls. Just then the princess entered the room with the family doctor. The prince moved away, trying not to show how absurd he thought the whole farce. The princess was confused and did not know what to do. She felt guilty toward Kitty.
"Well, Doctor, decide our fate," she said. "Tell me everything. Is there any hope?" she meant to ask, but her lips trembled, and she could not utter that question, and only added, "Well, Doctor?"
"In a moment, Princess. I will just have a talk with my colleague, and then I shall have the honour of giving you my opinion."
"Then we had better leave you."
"As you please."
The Princess left the room with a sigh. When the doctors were alone, the family doctor began timidly to express his opinion, which was that a tuberculous process had begun, but etc. The celebrity listened, but in the midst of the speech looked at his large gold watch.
"Yes," said he, "but—"
The family doctor stopped respectfully in the middle of what he was saying.
"We cannot, as you know, determine the beginning of a tuberculous process. As long as there are no cavities, there is nothing definite to go by. But we may suspect it, and there are indications, bad appetite, nervous excitability, and so on. The question is this. When a tuberculous process is suspected, what should be done to nourish the patient?"
"But you know, in these cases there's always some hidden moral cause,"
the family doctor allowed himself to remark with a subtle smile.
"Oh, yes, that goes without saying," replied the celebrity,
and again looked at his watch.
"Excuse me, has the bridge over the Yauza been repaired, or has one still to drive round?" he asked.
"Oh, it has been repaired. Well, then, I can get there in 20 minutes. We were saying that the question is this, how to nourish the patient and strengthen the nerves. The two aims are connected, and we must act on both."
"How about a journey abroad?" asked the family doctor.
"I'm opposed to journeys abroad. You see, if a tuberculous process has begun, which we don't know, a journey abroad will not help the case. Something is necessary which will nourish the patient and do no harm."
And the celebrity explained his plan of a treatment with soden water, the chief reason for prescribing this evidently being that it could do no harm. The family doctor listened attentively and respectfully to the end.
"But in favour of a journey abroad, I should like to mention the change of habits and the removal from surroundings which awaken memories. Besides which, the mother wishes it," said he.
"Oh, in that case, let them go. Only those German quacks will do mischief. They must obey. However, let them go."
He again glanced at his watch.
"I must be going,"
he said, moving toward the door. The celebrity informed the princess, his sense of what was fitting suggested this to him, that he would have to see the patient again.
"What, another examination?" exclaimed the mother, horror-struck.
"Oh, no, I must only find out a few details, Princess."
"If you please, Doctor." And the mother, followed by the doctor, entered the room in the middle of which Kitty was standing. Her thin cheeks were flushed, and her eyes were burning after the ordeal she had endured. When the doctor entered, she blushed all over, and her eyes filled with tears. Her whole illness and the treatment appeared to her stupid and even ridiculous. Her treatment seemed to her as absurd as piecing together the bits of a smashed vase. Her heart was broken. Why did they want to dose her with pills and powders? But she did not want to pain her mother, especially as her mother considered herself to blame.
"Sit down, please, Princess," said the celebrity.
He sat down opposite to her, smiling, felt her pulse, and again began asking tiresome questions. She answered him, but suddenly grew angry and rose.
"Excuse me, Doctor, but really this won't lead to anything. You are asking me the same things 3 times over.
The celebrity was not offended.
"It's only the excitability of an invalid," he said to the mother, after Kitty had gone out. "And I had finished."
And to the princess, as to an exceptionally intelligent woman, the doctor diagnosed Kitty's condition in learned language, and concluded with directions how the unnecessary waters were to be drunk. In reply to the question whether they should go abroad, the doctor thought deeply, as if solving a difficult problem, and at last he decided that they should go, but should not believe the quacks, and when in doubt, should always refer to him. It was just as if something pleasant had happened when the doctor had gone, and Kitty too pretended to be cheerful. She often now, almost always, had to pretend.
Really, Mama, I'm quite well.
But if you wish to travel, let us go. And trying to appear interested in the journey, she began to talk about the preparations for it.
Chapter 2. Just after the doctor had left, Dolly came. She knew that there was to be a consultation that day, and though she had only recently got up after a confinement, she had given birth to a daughter at the end of the winter, and though she had many troubles and cares of her own, she left her baby and another little girl of hers who was ill, and called to hear Kitty's fate, which was to be decided that day.
"Well, how is she?" she said, entering the drawing-room without removing her bonnet. "You're all cheerful, so it must be all right."
They tried to tell her what the doctor had said, but it turned out that though he had spoken very fluently and at great length, it was impossible to reproduce what he had said. The only thing of interest was that it had been decided they should go abroad. Dolly could not suppress a sigh. Her best friend, her sister, was going away, and as it was, her life was not a bright one. Her relations with her husband after their reconciliation had become humiliating. Anna's soldering had not proved durable, and the family harmony had broken again at the same place. There was nothing definite, but Oblonsky was hardly ever at home, there was hardly ever any money, and suspicions of his infidelity continually tormented Dolly, who tried to repel them, fearing the already familiar pangs of jealousy. The first explosion of jealousy, once past, could not be repeated. Not even the discovery of an act of infidelity could again affect her as it had done the first time. Such a discovery could now only deprive her of her accustomed family life, and she let herself be deceived, despising him and especially herself for such weakness. Added to this, the care of a large family worried her continually. Either something went wrong with the feeding of the baby, or the nurse left, or, as now, one of the children fell ill.
"And how are you all getting on?" asked her mother.
"Ah, Mama, we have plenty of trouble of our own. Lily has fallen ill, and I'm afraid it's scarlet fever. I have come out today to hear the news, because I shall not come out at all if, which, God forbid, it really is scarlet fever."
The old prince came out of his study after the doctor had gone, and, after giving his cheek to Dolly and greeting her, he turned to his wife.
"Well, have you made up your minds to go? And what are you going to do with me?"
"I think you should stay behind, Alexander," replied his wife.
"As you please."
"Mama, why should not Papa come with us?" said Kitty.
"It would be pleasanter for him, and for us too."
The old prince rose and stroked Kitty's hair. She lifted her face, and forcing a smile, looked up at him. She always felt that he understood her better than anyone else in the family, though he did not speak much to her. Being the youngest, she was his favourite, and it seemed to her that his affection gave him insight. When her gaze now met his kindly blue eyes looking steadily at her, it seemed to her that he saw right through her and knew all the trouble that was in her. She bent toward him, blushing and expecting a kiss, but he only patted her on the head and remarked,
"These stupid chignons. One can't get at one's real daughter, but only caresses the hair of expired females." "Well, Dolly," he said, turning to his eldest daughter, "and what is your prodigal about?"
"Nothing particular, Papa," answered Dolly,
understanding that he referred to her husband. "He's always out. I hardly see him," she could not resist adding with an ironical smile.
"And has he not yet gone to the country to sell the forest?"
"No, he's always preparing to go."
"Dear me," said the prince. "And so I am also to prepare. I'm all obedience," he said to his wife as he sat down again. "And look here, Kate," he went on, turning to his youngest daughter. "You must wake up one fine morning and say to yourself, 'Why, I'm quite well and happy, and we'll go out to walk in the frost again with Papa, eh?'"
Her father's words seemed very simple, but they made Kitty feel as confused and flurried as a detected criminal.
Yes, he knows and understands it all, and in these words is telling me that though I am ashamed, I must get over my shame. She could not gather spirit enough to reply. She made an attempt, but suddenly burst into tears and ran away. The princess flew at her husband.
That comes of your jokes. You always...
And she began reproaching him. The prince listened for some time to her rebukes in silence, but his face frowned more and more.
She is so pitiful, poor thing, so pitiful, and you don't feel that every allusion to what has caused it hurts her. Oh dear, to be so mistaken in anyone, said the princess.
And from the change in her tone, both Dolly and the prince knew that she was thinking of Vronsky.
I can't think why we have no laws to punish such horrid, ignoble people.
Oh, it makes me sick to hear it, muttered the prince gloomily, rising as if he meant to go away, but stopping at the door. The laws are there, my dear, and since you have invited it, I will tell you who is at fault for it all. You. And you, and no one but you. There always have been, and there still are, laws against such fellows. Yes, and if nothing had been done that ought not to have been done, I, old as I am, would have challenged him, that fop. Yes. Now, go and dose her, and call in these quacks.
The prince appeared to have much more to say, but as soon as the princess heard his tone, she, as always happened in serious cases, gave in and became repentant.
Alexander, Alexander,
she whispered, moving nearer and bursting into tears. As soon as she began to cry, the prince quieted down and came up to her.
That will do. That will do. You suffer too, I know. It can't be helped. There's no great harm done. God is merciful. Thank you,
he went on, no longer knowing what he was saying, and after responding to his wife's wet kiss, which he felt on his hand, he went out. When Kitty, in tears, had left the room, Dolly, with her motherly habit of mind, at once saw that here a woman's task lay before her, and prepared to fulfil it. She took off her bonnet, and having mentally rolled up her sleeves, prepared for action. While her mother was attacking her father, she tried to restrain the former as far as filial respect permitted. When the prince flared up, she kept silent, feeling shame for her mother and tenderness toward her father because of his immediate return to kindliness. But when her father left the room, she was ready for the chief thing needful, which was to go to Kitty and comfort her. I wanted to tell you something long ago, Mama. Do you know that Levin wished to propose to Kitty when he was here last? He told Stepan. Well, what of that? I don't understand. Perhaps Kitty rejected him? Did she not tell you? No, she told me nothing about either. She's too proud, but... I know it is all because of that. Yes, and just imagine if she refused Levin, and she would not have refused him if it had not been for that other. I know. And then the other deceived her so dreadfully. It was too dreadful for the princess to think how much she was to blame in regard to her daughter, and she grew angry.
Oh, I can't make anything out. Nowadays girls all want to trust to their own reason. They don't tell their mothers anything, and then...
Mama, I will go to her.
Go? Am I preventing you?
Said the mother. Chapter 3 On entering Kitty's little snuggery, a pretty pink room decorated with vieux Saxe figures, as fresh, rosy, and gay as Kitty herself had been 2 months before, Dolly remembered how light-heartedly and with what love they two had arranged that room the year before. Her heart grew chill when she saw Kitty sitting on the low chair nearest the door, her eyes fixed on a corner of the carpet. Kitty glanced at her sister, but the cold and rather severe expression of her face did not change. "I'm going home now, and shall have to shut myself up, and you won't be able to come to me,"
said Dolly, sitting down beside her sister. I want to talk to you.
What about?
Asked Kitty quickly, lifting her face in alarm.
What but your troubles?
I have no troubles.
Oh, come now, Kitty. Do you think I can help knowing? I know everything, and believe me, it is so unimportant. We have all passed through the same.
Kitty was silent, and her face looked stern. He is not worthy of your suffering for him, continued Dolly, going straight to the point.
No, because he has despised me, said Kitty with a shaking voice. Don't speak, please, don't speak.
But who told you so? Nobody says so. I'm sure he was in love with you, and is still in love, but...
Oh, dear, these commiserations are what I dread most of all, cried Kitty, suddenly flaring up.
She turned on her chair, blushed, and began rapidly moving her fingers, pressing now with one hand and now with the other the buckle of a belt she was holding. Dolly knew her sister's habit of fingering something when she was heated, and she knew how apt Kitty was to forget herself when in a passion, and to say much that was unpleasant and had better not have been said. She tried to pacify her, but it was too late.
"What do you want me to feel? What?"
said Kitty quickly.
"That I was in love with a man who wouldn't have anything to do with me, and that I am dying for love of him, and it is my sister who says that to me? My sister who imagines that she sympathizes with me? I don't want this commiseration and hypocrisy."
Kitty, you are unfair.
Why do you torment me?
On the contrary, I see you are in distress. But Kitty, in her excitement, did not listen to her.
There is nothing for me to grieve for or seek comfort about. I have enough pride never to let myself love a man who does not love me.
But I'm not suggesting it. Only tell me frankly, said Dolly, taking her by the hand. Did Lievin speak to you? The mention of Lievin seemed to deprive Kitty of the last fragments of self-control. She jumped up from her chair, threw the buckle on the floor, and rapidly gesticulating with her hands, she began,
"What has Lievin to do with it? I don't understand why you need torment me. I have said, and I repeat, I will never, never do what you are doing, returning to a man who has betrayed you and has loved another woman. I can't understand it. You may do it, but I can't."
Having said these words, she looked at her sister, and seeing that Dolly remained silent, with her head bowed sadly, Kitty, instead of leaving the room as she had intended to do, sat down by the door, and, hiding her face in her handkerchief, let her head sink down. For a minute or two there was silence. Dolly was thinking about herself. The humiliation of which she was always conscious was peculiarly painful when her sister touched on it. She had not expected such cruelty from her, and was angry with her. But suddenly she heard the rustle of a dress, and a burst of suppressed sobbing. A pair of arms encircled her neck from below, and Kitty was kneeling before her.
Dolly, dear, I am so, so unhappy,
she whispered guiltily. And the sweet, tear-stained face hid itself in the folds of Dolly's dress. As if tears were the necessary lubricant without which the machine of mutual confidence could not work properly between the sisters, after having had a cry they started talking of indifferent matters and in so doing understood one another. Kitty knew that what she had said in her anger about the unfaithfulness of Dolly's husband and about her humiliation had cut her poor sister to the depths of her heart, but that she was forgiven. While Dolly, on her side, learned all that she wanted to know, her suspicions were confirmed, and she understood that Kitty's grief, her hopeless grief, was really caused by the fact that Lievin had proposed to her, and that she had rejected him. And now that Vronsky had deceived her, she was prepared to love Lievin and to hate Vronsky. Kitty did not say a word of this. She spoke only of her state of mind.
I have no troubles, whatever, she said when she had grown calm. But can you understand that everything has become horrid, disgusting, and coarse to me, and above all, I myself? You can't think what horrid thoughts I have about everything.
And what horrid thoughts can you have? Asked Dolly, smiling.
the very nastiest and coarsest, I can't tell you. It is not grief, not dullness, but much worse. It is as if all that was good in me had hidden itself, and only what is horrid remains. How am I to tell you? She continued, noticing perplexity in her sister's eyes. Papa began to speak to me just now. It seems to me that he thinks that all I need is to get married. Mama takes me to a ball, and it seems to me she only takes me there to marry me off as quickly as possible and get rid of me. I know it is not true, but I can't get rid of the idea. I can't bear to see the so-called eligible men. I always think they're taking my measure. Formerly, to go anywhere in a ball dress was just a pleasure to me. I used to like myself in it, but now I feel ashamed and uncomfortable. Well, what is one to do? The doctor... Kitty became confused. She was going to say that since this change had come over her, Oblonsky had become intolerably disagreeable to her, and that she could not see him without having the coarsest and most monstrous fancies. Well, you see, everything appears to me in the coarsest and most horrid aspect, she continued. That is my illness. Perhaps it will pass. But don't think I can't. I only feel comfortable with children, only in your house. What a pity you can't come to see us. But I will come. I have had scarlet fever, and I will persuade Mama to let me. And Kitty insisted on having her own way, went to her sister's, and nursed the children all through the scarlet fever that really attacked them. The two sisters nursed all the six children successfully through the illness, but Kitty's health did not improve, and in Lent the Shcherbatskys went abroad. Chapter 4. The highest Petersburg society is really all one. All who belong to it know and even visit one another. But this large circle has its subdivisions. Anna Arkadyevna Karenina had friends and close connections in three different sets. One of these was her husband's official set, consisting of his colleagues and subordinates, who in most varied and capricious ways were connected and separated by social conditions. Anna found it hard now to recall the feeling of almost religious respect she had at first felt for these people. Now she knew them all as well as the inhabitants of a provincial town know one another. She knew the habits and weaknesses of each of them, and where the shoe pinched this or that foot. She knew their relations to one another and to the governing centre. She knew who sided with whom, and how and by what means each supported himself, and who agreed or disagreed with whom and about what. But, in spite of admonitions and advice from the Countess Lydia Ivanovna, this bureaucratic circle of male interests could not interest Anna, and she avoided it. Another circle with which Anna was intimate was that through which Karenin had made his career. The centre of that circle was the Countess Lydia Ivanovna. It consisted of elderly, plain, philanthropic, and pious women, and clever, well-educated, ambitious men. One of the clever men who belonged to it called it the conscience of Petersburg society. Karenin set great value on this circle, and Anna, who knew how to get on with everyone, had, during the first part of her life in Petersburg, made friends in it too. But now, on her return from Moscow, that circle became unbearable to her. It seemed to her that she and all of them were only pretending, and she felt so bored and uncomfortable in that society that she visited Lydia Ivanovna as rarely as possible. The third circle with which Anna was connected was society in the accepted meaning of the word, the society of balls, dinner parties, brilliant toilette, the society which clung to the court with one hand lest it should sink to the demi-monde. For this the members of that society thought they despised, though its tastes were not only similar but identical with their own. Anna was connected with this set through the Princess Betsy Tverskaya, the wife of her cousin, who had an income of 120,000 rubles a year, and who, from the time Anna first appeared in society, had particularly liked her, made much of her, and drawn her into her own set, making fun of that to which the Countess Lydia Ivanovna belonged. "When I am old and ugly, I will become like that," Betsy used to say. "But for you, a young and beautiful woman, it is too early to settle down in that almshouse." At first, Anna had avoided the Princess Tverskaya's set as much as she could, because it demanded more expense than she could afford, and also because she really approved more of the other set. But after her visit to Moscow, all this was reversed. She avoided her moral friends and went into grand society. There she saw Vronsky, and experienced a tremulous joy when meeting him. She met him most frequently at Betsy's, who was a Vronsky herself and his cousin. Vronsky went everywhere where he had a chance of meeting Anna, and spoke to her of his love whenever he could. She gave him no encouragement, but every time they met there sprang up that feeling of animation which had seized her in the train on the morning when she first saw him. She was aware that when they met, joy lit up her eyes and drew her lips into a smile, but she could not hide the expression of that joy. At first, Anna sincerely believed that she was displeased with him for allowing himself to persecute her. But soon after her return from Moscow, having gone to a party where she expected to meet him but to which she did not come, she clearly realized, by the sadness that overcame her, that she had been deceiving herself, and that his persecution supplied the whole interest of her life. A famous prima donna was giving her second performance, and all high society was at the opera house. Vronsky, from the front row of the stalls, seeing his cousin, went to her box without waiting for the interval. "Why did you not come to dinner?" she said, adding with a smile, and so that only he could hear her, "I am amazed at the clairvoyance of lovers. She was not there. But come in after the opera." Vronsky looked at her inquiringly. She nodded, and he thanked her by a smile and sat down beside her. "And how well I remember your ridicule," continued the Princess Betsy, who took particular pleasure in following the progress of this passion. "What has become of it all? You are caught, my dear fellow."
"I wish for nothing better than to be caught," replied Vronsky, with his calm, good-natured smile. "To tell the truth, if I complain at all, it is only of not being caught enough. I am beginning to lose hope."
"What hope can you have?" said Betsy, offended on her friend's behalf.
"Entendons-nous."
But in her eyes little sparks twinkled which said that she understood very well, and just as he did, what hope he might have.
"None whatever," said Vronsky, laughing and showing his close-set teeth. "Excuse me," he added, taking from her hand the opera glasses, and he set to work to scan across her bare shoulder the row of boxes opposite. "I am afraid I am becoming ridiculous." He knew very well that he ran no risk of appearing ridiculous either in Betsy's eyes or in the eyes of society people generally. He knew very well that in their eyes the role of the disappointed lover of a maiden or of any single woman might be ridiculous, but the role of a man who was pursuing a married woman and who made it the purpose of his life at all cost to draw her into adultery was one which had in it something beautiful and dignified and could never be ridiculous. So it was with a proud, glad smile lurking under his moustache that he put down the opera glasses and looked at his cousin.
"And why did you not come to dinner?" she said admiringly.
"I must tell you about that. I was engaged, and with what do you think? I'll give you 100 or 1,000 guesses, and you won't find out. I was making peace between a husband and a fellow who had insulted his wife. Yes, really."
"Well, and did you succeed?"
"Nearly."
"You must tell me all about it," she said, rising. "Come back in the next interval."
"I can't. I'm going to the French Theatre."
"What? From Nielsen?" asked Betsy, quite horrified, though she could not have distinguished Nielsen's voice from that of a chorus girl.
"It can't be helped. I have an appointment there in connection with this same peacemaking of mine."
"Blessed are the peacemakers, for they will be saved," said Betsy, remembering that she had heard someone say something like that. "Well, then, sit down and tell me about it." and she sat down again. Chapter 5